Headlines. The Holy Quran is once again desecrated in the Swedish capital of Stockholm, despite growing outrage across the Muslim world. Iran and Syria call for the immediate withdrawal of American and other illegitimate foreign forces from Syrian soil. And Niger's junta says former colonial power France is seeking to intervene militarily to reinstate deposed President Mohamed Bazoum. Hello and welcome. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the Holy Quran has been desecrated once again in the Swedish capital of Stockholm, despite growing outrage across the Muslim world. Two men named Salwan Momika and Salwan Najem burned pages of the Holy Book in front of the Swedish parliament. Police had granted the permit in advance. Momika had carried out the same actions twice before in the past 40 days, outside Stockholm's main mosque and later outside the Iraqi embassy. Both incidents led to outrage and condemnations worldwide. Meanwhile, Denmark has reacted to similar actions there, following backlash over such incidents. On Sunday, the Danish Foreign Ministry said it has explored legal means of stopping the desecration of the holy books. The Swedish Prime Minister also said a similar process was already underway in his country. Well, an Iraqi woman who went viral on social media attempting to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Boz al-Samaraya says she suffered injuries during a confrontation with two far-right activists and was later arrested on charges of theft. Robert Carter has traveled to Denmark to meet with her and has filed this report.
The Arab woman who took on two far-right activists in a bid to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Iraqi-Danish citizen Quds al-Samarai risked her own life while en route to visit a friend on Monday, the 24th of July. The footage of the incident, which occurred outside Iraq's embassy, went viral on social media. The video clearly shows Quds grabbing the Quran before being wrestled to the ground by the two men. In one instance, one of the desecrators can be seen with his hands reaching for her neck. Police later arrested Quds on accusations she was stealing the Quran from the activists. Quds explained how the incident left her with minor injuries, but no regrets.
Here the police dragged me, and the man was shouting that I stole his property. I think he was scared because he knew hitting me was wrong, so he had to justify it by saying I stole. As soon as the police heard the word stealing, they immediately put me in handcuffs and gave him back the Quran. The police asked me what happened. I said I saw our Quran being burned, and I just wanted to put it out. And then I saw another Quran with shoes on it, and I wanted to take the shoe off. But I didn't realize that the shoe was nailed on the Quran. I told the police they hit me and strangled me, but they replied with, it's their freedom of speech. So I replied, okay, so it's also my freedom of speech to protect the Quran. I thought the police came to help me, but they turned out to twist the story by saying I was trying to steal.
Quds now faces a day in court, while her injuries have left her struggling to walk. Meanwhile, Muslims across the world remain in a state of anger as calls for serious action and retaliation to Europe's defense of far-right hate speech continues.
Despite Copenhagen officially condemning the incident, which occurred just where we stand outside Iraq's embassy a few days ago, that doesn't mean that they've outlawed the practice. And according to reports, several other similar incidents have already occurred since, with far-right activists again targeting the diplomatic buildings of Muslim-majority nations here in the Danish capital. However, this has come at a price. Denmark's defense of the so-called free speech of far-right activists to attack Islam's holy sanctities has led to both Denmark and Sweden's reputation to plummet across the Muslim world. Questions should surely be asked now whether it is indeed within the diplomatic interests of European countries to defend such a fringe extremist practice when, of course, there is so much at stake with economic backlashes from the Muslim world. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Tehran says it will vigorously continue efforts and support for lasting peace, stability, and security in the region. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the announcement at a joint presser with his Syrian counterpart Faisal Mehdad in Tehran. He condemned Israel's attacks on Syria, calling regime the main instigator of instability in the region. The top diplomat also touched upon agreements between Tehran and Damascus, saying they are now in the implementation phase. He added that the two sides are working to reach more agreements in various sectors, including the economy and transit. Faisal Mehdad, for his part, slammed Washington's military presence in the Arab state under the pretext of fighting terrorist groups. He called for the immediate withdrawal of all illegitimate forces from Syrian soil. Mehdad also reaffirmed his country's determination to strengthen cooperation with regional states in defiance of the West's obstructionism. Well, Palestinian factions have held a meeting in Egypt to discuss reconciliation and a unified stance against Israel. We've covered the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen at what our guests had to say.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Leaders of different Palestinian groups and resistance movements in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip have held unity talks in Egypt. The meeting in the city of El Alamein was called by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to create a unified stance to confront the Israeli occupation. Abbas also announced the formation of a committee to continue dialogue and to end divisions. The head of the Political Bureau of Hamas Resistance Movement also attended the meeting. Ismail Haniyeh called on Abbas to end the Palestinian Authority's political arrest and security collaboration with Israel. The Gaza-based Islamic Jihad movement, however, boycotted the talks. Its head, Ziad al-Nakhala, said the Palestinian Authority must release detained members of the resistance movements in the occupied West Bank before the Islamic Jihad joins the talks. A correspondent from occupied Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joins us to give us the latest on these talks. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer from Bali, Indonesia, who joins us for an analysis. Okay, Mona, first to you. Tell us what has come out of these talks so far.
The main issue is to come after this meeting and to declare the end of the division. Only this way the Palestinians will accept this meeting and the previous meetings had succeeded. The end of the division must be declared. Otherwise, the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas declared that the formation of a committee to continue the efforts in order to continue the dialogue, to end the divisions, and achieve Palestinian national unity. So after the meeting, there would be a committee to follow up the dialogue and to follow up the issues that had been discussed between Abbas and Haniyeh. Hamas movement at the same time said there is an urgent need for the formation of the Palestinian parliament. A new parliament must be formed. Otherwise, nothing would change. Jihad movement said that they will not take part in the meetings unless the Palestinian Authority releases all the Palestinian prisoners, political prisoners arrested by the PA in the occupied West Bank. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine say that the Oslo Accords must immediately end and that the Palestinian Authority must take other issues in order or other tracks in order to achieve unity on ground.
How do you see the fact that their talks are taking place, even though there's been a boycott by a couple of the groups, in the face of what's happening inside the occupied territories?
Please forgive me for being a bit cynical, but I think the parties come to these talks from a very different position. And Mohammed Abbas, I would argue, comes to these talks from the position of widespread dissatisfaction with him and his party, to the point where he's widely being dismissed as a collaborator, and he needs to shore up his popular support to the extent he can. But he continues to embrace this reality that sees him a champion for nonviolent resistance only, and very much opposed to armed resistance. And he takes the position that his party is the only legitimate government in Palestine. So it's hard to see, as a number of Palestinian political scientists are observing, that this is really going to go very far, certainly any further than the deal made last year in August did, albeit that at least this time Abbas is present, whereas last year the agreement was signed by a senior Fatah official on his behalf and contemplated that elections would be held in August of this year, which is clearly not going to happen. On the other hand, Hamas's vision of what needs to take place is impeccable. Let's try to remember that Fatah and the Palestinian Authority was always conceived as a temporary solution born of the Oslo Accords in the 90s. And it's high time they were sent packing. It's high time that an election was held in Palestine without foreign interests pursuing their own agenda, deciding who may and may not stand for election by, in a political move, designating anyone that would oppose the Palestinian Authority to be a terrorist organization. That's completely absurd when anybody with just a basic understanding of international law recognizes that an occupied people are entitled to engage in armed resistance. So whatever it is that they're doing, it's not terrorism. All right. But Hamas, for its part, is calling on the Palestinian Authority to end security collaboration with the occupation, to release political prisoners and stop arresting them, to create a parliament that represents all of Palestine, to get back to the agenda of establishing a recognized and globally accepted Palestinian state, and to deal with the threat posed by the occupation in those lands which remain occupied. And it's very difficult to argue against that. And my personal view is that Abbas is participating in this because he doesn't have any choice, given the total lack of support that is starting to be felt by him. But having said that, the fact that he's talking about referring this to a committee is worrisome. I mean, there's a quite well-known Palestinian political scientist named Abu Sada. He said, this is no cause for celebration, and the surest way to kill an initiative is to refer it to a committee. And I suspect that's ultimately what Mohammed Abbas is looking to do, while at the same time engaging in a series of appearances designed to garner support for the Palestinian Authority under his rule. He's 87 years old. In many ways, his overstaying any mandate that he might have had in the 90s is highly reminiscent of what Hadi has done in Yemen. I think it's time for him to stand down and go away and let Palestinians that are concerned with Palestine rather than with providing security to the occupation run their own government.
With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
We'll continue with other news this hour. A ceasefire has been reached after 2 days of violent clashes between the Palestinian Fatah Party and other factions in southern Lebanon, which claim at least 6 lives. The fighting in Ain al-Helwa refugee camp near the southern coastal city of Sidon first flared up on Sunday after a Fatah commander was killed in an ambush. According to a Lebanese parliamentarian, the two sides have also agreed to a probe into the killing and the arrest of all those responsible. The Lebanese prime minister has called for an end to the tensions. A ceasefire mediated by Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement failed to end the fighting. Some 400,000 displaced Palestinians live in 12 refugee camps in Lebanon. The camps mainly lie outside the jurisdiction of the Lebanese security services. Well, the Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for one of the deadliest bombings to hit northwestern Pakistan in recent years. The death toll now stands at 54. 200 people were also injured. Now, the suicide attack took place in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province that borders Afghanistan. It targeted an election rally for a pro-Taliban cleric. A regional Daesh affiliate based in Afghanistan's Nangarhar province is a rival of the Afghan Taliban and Al-Qaeda. The Pakistani government has promised to hunt down those behind the terrorist attack. Condemnations and condolences have been pouring in from across the world. Neighboring Iran has slammed the attack as indiscriminate and inhumane. Tehran regards terrorism and extremism as a common security concern for both countries. Niger's junta says former colonial power France is plotting to intervene militarily to reinstate the deposed president.
In its search for ways and means to intervene militarily in Niger, France, with the complicity of some Nigerians, held a meeting with the chief of staff of the Nigerian National Guard to obtain the necessary political and military authorization.
French President Emmanuel Macron has vowed immediate and uncompromising action if French citizens or interests are attacked. On Sunday, thousands of people rallied outside the French embassy to condemn Paris for suspending aid to the West African country. Some of them tried to enter the compound, but were dispersed with tear gas. Protesters also demanded the immediate departure of all Western troops, including those of France. Niger's pro-West President Mohamed Bazoum has vowed not to resign, even though he has been held for 5 days following a coup toppling his government. The junta has also arrested the president of the former ruling party, as well as the oil and mining ministers. Now to Pakistan, where the Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for one of the deadliest bombings to hit northwestern Pakistan in recent years. The death toll now stands at 54. 200 people were also injured. Well, the suicide attack took place in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province that borders Afghanistan. It targeted an election rally for a pro-Taliban cleric. A regional Daesh affiliate based in Afghanistan's Nangarhar province is a rival of the Afghan Taliban and Al-Qaeda. The Pakistani government has promised to hunt down those behind the terrorist attack. Condemnations and condolences have been pouring in from across the world. Neighboring Iran has slammed the attack as indiscriminate and inhumane. Tehran regards terrorism and extremism as a common security concern for both countries. And with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Afrocom head has said BRICS payment system will replace SWIFT in new non-Western world. Igor Morozov has said the continent will be part of a multipolar world with completely new economic relations. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media website and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, the unipolar world is collapsing and a multipolar world is being formed with the participation of Africa, where a newly minted middle class will drive consumer demand in the near future. The head of the Coordinating Committee for Economic Cooperation with African Countries, AfroCom, Igor Morozov, told RT recently. Last year alone, 19 African countries applied for BRICS membership because they wanted completely new economic relations, Morozov revealed on the sidelines of the Russia-Africa summit. After the US and the EU seized Russia's forex reserves, the world realized that it is not only a political weapon, but an instrument of financial pressure on the external and internal policy of any country and any continent, according to Morozov. The US dollar has been weaponized, which is why nations will gradually move away from using it in trade, and the BRICS payment system will replace the SWIFT financial messaging network in a new non-Western world. He said, African leaders are also concerned about further use of the dollar and euro. In this regard, the number of countries wishing to join BRICS is growing rapidly because this is an alternative payment system that is due to emerge within half a year. BRICS is pushing towards trade in national currencies and has begun efforts to establish a joint payment network to cut off reliance on the Western financial system, particularly the dollar. Russian trade ties with African countries have been strengthening in recent years, and there is more room for growth, including through free trade zones that are actively developing in African countries, Morozov noted. He stated, "We are ready and we will supply annually through humanitarian aid everything that we have in the agro-industrial complex, our tractors, aggregates, mineral fertilizers, and technologies. We've achieved amazing results in 10 years, and we want to share this experience with our African counterparts." He added that Russia would do everything to ensure the African economy has a future with access to innovative technologies. Meanwhile, one of Russia's top bankers has said alternative payment mechanisms will be addressed very soon. Speaking to journalists on the sidelines of the event in St. Petersburg, Andrei Kostin, the CEO of Russia's second largest bank, VTB, has said that the US dollar had been weaponized, which is why nations will gradually move away from using it in trade. Kostin said structural changes are bound to happen. African countries are also acting on this. They have already started to create their own systems of information exchange and settlements in national currencies. This is a promising trend. He concluded a share of trade settlements in alternative currencies will continue to increase. Russia and its trade partners among the developing nations, such as fellow BRICS members Brazil, China, India, and South Africa, have started to switch to alternative currencies in mutual trade after sanctions effectively cut Moscow off from the Western financial system. A growing number of nations have expressed their support of the trend. President Putin revealed earlier this month that over 80% of transactions between Moscow and its largest trading partner Beijing are settled in rubles and yuan. Russia announced plans earlier this month to launch negotiations on the switch to national currencies with countries in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, namely Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. According to Global Times, as South Africa will host the 15th BRICS Summit in its financial hub, Johannesburg, from August 22nd to 24th, the five BRICS countries, including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, will discuss establishing sustainable payment mechanisms for mutual trade among key issues to be discussed at the summit. The move comes as more and more developing countries are seeking alternatives to reduce their dependence on the US dollar. Experts said that the dollar, used as a tool for the US to exercise international hegemony, has resulted in great uncertainty for the recovery of the world economy. The BRICS countries, including Russia, have been seeking to shift further from the dollar in mutual trade, with the de-dollarization trend gaining momentum following Western sanctions that cut Russia off from Western financial mechanisms. South Africa's Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, Nadeli Pandor, said after the BRICS foreign ministers' meeting on June 1st that the new development bank, NDB, is studying the potential use of alternative currencies to the dollar to ensure that we do not become victim to sanctions, Reuters reported.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Brothers and sisters, the title of our series of lectures is Karbala, the Enlightened Journey. And as you heard yesterday evening, this enlightenment that is happening is an enlightenment from what we refer to as the Jahiliyyah. Jahiliyyah is a Quranic term which refers to the time period and the lifestyle of ignorance that predated Islam. Yesterday you saw how the Quran refers to Jahiliyyah in the context of people having misplaced beliefs. It refers to Jahiliyyah in the context of people who have adopted certain practices which are contrary to Islamic teachings and Islamic practices. Today I want to quote to you another ayah to begin our discussion. This is from Surah Al-Fath 48:26, where Allah Ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم إذ جعل الذين كفروا في قلوبهم الحمية حمية الجاهلية. Allah tells the Muslims and the Prophet that remember this incident in history when the kuffar, the stubborn, arrogant disbelievers, they had put in their hearts the feeling of hamiya. Hamiya is a word which comes from the word hami, which means heat. Now, what is this heat which results in a feeling? You know how when people are angry and they're very passionate about something, their temperature starts to rise, and oftentimes like they will start raising their voice, maybe even the color of their skin will become red, and they become passionate about what they have in their hearts. Now, when that passion gets to an extreme level where it blinds somebody from seeing the truth, and somebody acts according to prejudice and bigotry and standards which are unjust, that is referred to as hamiya, an unjust bigotry. So Allah says that there was a time when the kuffar, they did this. What was the incident? It is the incident that led to the signing of the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. You know that the Muslims, upon the command of Allah, had gathered to perform the Hajj. But when they made their way to Mecca, the mushrikeen decided that they weren't going to let them in. It could have led to a war. But through the skillful negotiation of our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi, what ended up happening is that a truce was negotiated. This year they wouldn't go, but next year they would have the right to go. And they did end up going next year. Now, what was the reason for them not letting the Muslims perform the Hajj? In ancient times, the Hajj and the Kaaba were a sanctuary. It was a haram. To the point where they say that, let's say that somebody killed my own father, and I went in front of the Kaaba, and I happened to see the killer of my own father present right there at the Kaaba. Because of the sanctity of that place, I would not have a right to retaliate. That's not the place for it. It was considered above those type of things. But these people, because of the extreme amount of prejudice they had, they didn't want to lose face with the rest of the Arabs. They didn't want to say that, oh, you let your own enemy into your own homelands. You're going to be the laughingstock of the Arabs. Because of their wanting to hold on to that city of Mecca and not let the Muslims in, they said that we're not going to let you in. And they went further to prevent the Prophet's title from being written in the treaty. You know, the Prophet was Rasulullah, he was a messenger of Allah. But when the Muslims wanted to write this in, they said that no, we're not going to allow this to happen. Anyhow, Allah describes for us what's happening to them at that time. When they're making these decisions which are unjust, they're contrary to the truth, what's happening? Allah says that this is something which comes from jahiliyyah. This is part of the ignorance. This is something you have to be careful about. Now, as we said yesterday, the jahiliyyah that was there before Islam was something which the Quran refers to as al-jahiliyatul ula, the first jahiliyyah. And in hadith, we're told that there will be another jahiliyyah coming about. And what we'd like to do in the course of these lectures is to see what kind of jahiliyyah was present at the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and then to see what's happening in our current times. So at this point, I want to introduce you to one trend of thought that was taking place during the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, which actually began towards the end of the reign of the third Khalifa, which is called the school of the Murji'a. The Murji'a is a very interesting thing if you study Islamic history. What happened was that before this particular way of thinking came about, people used to be kind of pro one person or they were pro another person, right? They were, let's say, pro Imam Ali alayhi salam, or they were pro the first Khalifa or the second Khalifa, etc. But what happened with the incidents that led to the house arrest of the third Khalifa, his home was surrounded by people who were protesting the policies of his government. Now, there were those, of course, who were passionately supporting Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. They were with him. They were on his side. There were those who were passionately supporting Uthman. And there were those who said that, you know, in this incident that's taking place right here, we're not going to take a position. It's a new type of thinking that crept upon the Muslims at that time. What right do we have to judge between these people who have different positions? There's one incident in history. What happened? They They had gone away from the city. They went to perform Hajj. And when they come back to Medina, they officially declare their position. They say that we are going to do irja of this issue. Irja means that we're going to defer and delay any type of judgment. We're going to leave it to God. From our perspective, we have one Muslim here and we have another Muslim here. And who are we to judge? Now, of course, immediately the question comes about that if you have two different Muslims, then isn't it the case that, well, one of them is righteous and one of them is sinful? One of them is the paragon of virtue and truth and taqwa, and the other one is the paragon of, the third Khalifa was famous for, let's say, corruption and nepotism and all these other things. So can't you judge between them on that basis? So what they said is that, well, from our perspective, we have no right to question somebody on their actions. What's important is that you declare your faith. The actions come secondary. That's for God to judge. From our perspective, everyone is the same. And that began a new trend in the Muslim Ummah. Soon enough, the Murji'a trend began to expand. And now, particularly after the Shahada of Amir al-Mu'mineen, what happened is that they took on a more sophisticated stance. And this is, I'm saying this history, brothers and sisters, because it's very important. We're going to look and see how history repeats itself just soon. So what happens now? They said that, well, we have this position of neutrality, but now that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam has become shaheed, now the ruler of the time is Muawiyah. Now Muawiyah, from our perspective, is a Muslim. The judgment of Muawiyah is to God, and we are people who want peace. Now, if we're going to take a stance against Muawiyah and the leading government, because he's the governor at that time, he's the one who's in charge, then that's going to create conflict. So in order to create peace, we're going to align ourselves with Muawiyah, but we're not going to say anything against Imam Ali alayhi salam as well. That judgment is with God. Now, do you see, brothers and sisters, how things are moving along? This movement that started as a counter-movement to taking a stance, now it has become a movement of associating with the corrupt, unjust government of that time in the name of being neutral. And now we come to the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. One of the very interesting and useful things for us on these nights, inshallah, will be to see what was it that led people to abandon Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Oh, Hussein, you live forever
in our hearts and in our minds.
I swear to Allah and to my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Swear to Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible?
Mm-hmm. Rahi Quran.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
A Zionist court has ordered the removal of Palestinian Negev village to build Jewish neighborhood. Residents of Ras Jaraba, which predates the fabricated regime of Israel, says that despite concerns for their future, they will fight the decision to the end. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, the decision will affect 500 native people from Ras Jaraba village who have been left in a state of shock after the decision by the Be'er Sheva Magistrate Court recently. Residents of the village, which predates the establishment of the fabricated regime of Israel in 1948, say the news fell on them like a thunderbolt and was difficult to process. Musa al-Hawashle, a resident of Ras Jaraba, told Middle East Eye, young people have been calling me since the morning, telling me about their concerns for the future. We don't know where we will go. We have been here before the regime of Israel, and now we will be expelled from our homeland. The Ras Jaraba case began in 2019, when the Israel Land Authority, ILA, filed 10 eviction lawsuits against 127 residents of the village and their families. The government body argued that the presence of Ras Jaraba, which is unrecognized as an official village by the fabricated regime of Israel, hindered the expansion of the nearby city of Dimona. Dimona was built on land owned by the nomadic indigenous Palestinian tribe of Al-Hawashle, which also owns land in adjacent Ras Jaraba village. The fabricated regime of Israel wants to remove Ras Jaraba, an area of around 34 hectares, and replace it with a new neighborhood for Zionist citizens called Rotem, which will include thousands of housing units. Recently, a magistrate court ruled in favor of the Zionist regime and ordered the Palestinian families to leave the village they've lived in for generations, giving them a deadline of March 1, 2024. The families were also ordered to pay a sum of 117,000 shekels to cover legal expenses. Adala, the Haifa-based legal center for Arab minority rights, which is representing the Palestinian residents, said they will appeal against the decision. It argued that the court disregarded the residents' arguments in its judgment. Adala said in a statement, since the Nakba, the regime of Israel has employed a range of tools and policies to forcibly displace the Bedouin residents in the Naqab. Their livelihood has been confined to restricted areas and segregated townships, and they have been subjected to harsh living conditions with no regard for their basic needs and way of life. The forced displacement of Ras Jarabah residents to expand the Jewish city of Dimona, which was built on the residents' lands, serves as clear evidence that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid against its Palestinian citizens. Aboshla says that while residents will protest against the decision and fight it all the way in the courts, they have little hope in the current ultra-nationalist regime, which has placed the acceleration of Judaization of the Naqab at the heart of its guiding policy. Aboshla told Middle East Eye, "The new government is worse than the one before. They want to demolish the village to build a new neighborhood. The government has not offered alternative suggestions. It has been difficult to process and explain to the younger people. I worry about them, their future, and where they will go." According to Adala, Ras Jarabah residents suggested that their village be integrated into the newly planned part of Dimona, a request that was turned down. The village is one of around 30 unrecognized Palestinian villages in the Negev region of the Zionist regime's southern territory. Almost 100,000 Palestinians who held Israeli citizenship live in these unrecognized villages, which are denied any infrastructure or support from the regime of Israel government. There are no means of transportation, no roads, no schools, and Israeli authorities don't collaborate with their local leadership. Palestinian citizens of the occupied territories are the descendants of the native population, which was violently displaced by Zionist militias during the creation of the fabricated regime of Israel in 1948. At least 300,000 Palestinians live in the Negev region and say that Israeli regime authorities have attempted to force them out and destroy their nomadic way of life for decades through various tactics. These include confiscation of lands from native Palestinians and turning landowners into tenants. Additionally, the Israeli regime government has been accused of preventing the expansion of Palestinian villages and encircling them with new Zionist Jewish settlements. Youssef Al-Atwana, a Palestinian member of the Israeli parliament with the Hadash Tal coalition, told Middle East Eye, "The goal of the Israeli government is to take control over Arab land in the Naqab and to expel entire communities from the land. This has been ongoing since 1948, and some families have been displaced twice." The MP said he's collaborating with the Negev-based committee to organize a large-scale protest over the expulsions and projects taking place. He said, "People are very angry over the racism that is taking place. But despite the difficult circumstances, fines and displacements, people are remaining steadfast and strong," he added, predicting that the recent court decision will likely inflame tensions in the Negev. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported a Palestinian citizen was wounded in the hand on July 28 after Israeli regime settlers attacked his vehicle near the village of Al-Mughayr to the east of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Local sources told Wafa. A number of Zionist settlers attacked the vehicle of a citizen from the town of Beitounia near the village of Al-Mughayr, injuring him in the hand, the sources added. The vehicle's windshield was shattered as a result of the attack, while the man was taken Al-Mughayr Medical Center for treatment. Zionist settler violence against Palestinians and their property is commonplace in the West Bank and is backed and supported by the hard-right Israeli government. There are over 700,000 Zionist settlers illegally occupying portions of the West Bank in violation of international law and established norms prohibiting the relocation of the occupying power civil population to the land of the occupied.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The viewpoints of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala. Blood gained a victory over the sword on the day of Ashura, and Zainab al-Kubra was the cause of that victory. She and tens of other women and children were taken captive on the same day. They were paraded in different places. Some of the people who were watching them were cheerful and some were shedding tears. Zainab al-Kubra suddenly started a great mission in that critical situation. She spoke like her father did when he was delivering a sermon to his people during his rule. She spoke with the same tone. She spoke using the same kind of words Imam Ali alayhi salam would use. She was equally eloquent and precise, and her words were equally profound. O plotters and pretenders, maybe you yourselves were starting to believe that you were following Islam and the Holy Prophet's household, but you failed miserably in the test.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum.
أنا لاتشان.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لاتشان.
أنا لات.
You proved to be blind in the fitna. Do you pledge allegiance while you are planning a conspiracy? You can do nothing but engage in shifting allegiance, hypocrisy, flattery, self-humiliation, and empty talk. Your actions were different from your words. You became arrogant and wrongly thought that you were pious. You thought you were still revolutionary. You thought you were still the followers of the commander of the faithful. But the truth was something else. You were not able to deal with the fitna. You were not able to save yourselves. You ruined everything you had done before. Because of your lack of insight, your lack of knowledge of the situation, and your inability to distinguish right from wrong, you ruined everything you had built. You look faithful, and you keep making revolutionary claims, but deep down, you are empty and weak. Zainab al-Kubra presented a deep analysis of her society's pathologies. She spoke firmly and eloquently in that difficult situation.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.